Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrock. First on this week's program, the five most ridiculous things we saw at Donald Trump's rally in Tempe. This story was written by TJ LeHeroux and was posted on October 25th. A Donald Trump rally is always a weird time, like a homecoming for the fringiest corner of the Republican Party. Rows of people wearing near-identical outfits dot the stands, while a VIP area near the stage is a who's who of right-wing public figures. On Thursday, the former president held what could be his final Copper State rally at Arizona State University's Mullet Arena in Tempe. He is also scheduled to appear in Glendale on October 31st for an on-stage interview with Tucker Carlson. It felt like deja vu. That's because Trump was just in the state on October 13th for a rally in Prescott Valley, and the Tempe event hit all the same notes. It had a similar lineup of speakers, featured the same songs between speeches, and crescendoed to the same stale remarks from the former president, who got the same applause from the audience at the same points. Warming up the crowd for Trump in Tempe were Republican U.S. Senate candidate Kari Lake, Arizona GOP chair Gina Swoboda, failed presidential candidate and businessman Vivek Ramaswamy, and Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. Phoenix New Times was there. Here are some of the most ridiculous scenes from the day. Chumming it up. New Times spotted two unlikely attendees chatting. One was a glum-looking Joe Arpaio, the infamous former Maricopa County Sheriff. The other was former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, who famously got off to a bad start in the job defending Trump's claims about the size of his 2016 inauguration crowd, and ultimately left the administration 6 months later. Does Spicer have a shot at joining a second Trump administration? Definitely not, he told New Times. He was just in town for a private event in Tucson and decided to come, quote, as a supporter. Little Marco shills for Trump. Rubio, whom Trump demeaned as Little Marco during the 2016 campaign, was introduced by a faceless announcer as simply Rubio. The senator tried to riff on the introduction a la Trump, but ultimately lacked the comedic timing to land any jokes with the crowd. They didn't even say my first name. It's fine, Rubio said, adding that he hated his name when he was a kid, so he was actually happy his first name wasn't uttered. You guys have no humidity, he observed, calling the weather bad for the hair. Rubio also claimed that the Harris-Walz campaign wasn't even outlining its own plans for governing the country, which isn't true, and was all attacks, all viciousness toward the Trump campaign. It must have been a projection. The rest of the afternoon, speakers painted a picture of the country invoking blood, carnage, an immigrant invasion, and America's occupation by migrants, which, by the way, is also Harris's fault. The music. In the hour between speeches by Lake and Ramaswamy, music blasted out of Mullet Arena speaker system at an eardrum-shattering decibel level. This is fucking miserable, one veteran reporter could be overheard saying in the press section. At full volume, an endless parade of songs from musicals and operas, and the somehow too subtle for this crowd gay anthem, YMCA, assaulted the ears of rallygoers. Far worse than the ear-splitting volume was a performance earlier in the day by an artist named John Kahn. Nobody, not even members of the right-wing press, seemed to know who he was. The Los Angeles-based singer took the stage and asked, "So, this is a MAGA rally," pronouncing MAGA as MAGA, for some reason. He then played a song titled Fighter, which he said was written for Trump. The performance was not great. Khan seemed off pitch for most of the song, which was full of cliches. A lyrical sampling. I'm a fighter. No one can say that I'm a run and hider. I was born to be a do or dyer and make it righter. Garbage can is a fun word. Once Trump took the stage, he spent most of his remarks on immigration. He referred to America as a country under occupation, called for the biggest deportation program in American history, and in barely disguised fascistic language, said the day he wins the election will be Liberation Day. The former president told a story about two unnamed beautiful young girls who were stabbed by undocumented immigrants while walking to school. Short on any details, it's unclear if the story is true. We're going to get these animals out of here real fast, Trump declared. Trump also used a new phrase with which he instantly became obsessed. We're a dumping ground. We're like a garbage can for the world. That's what's happened. That's what's happened to we're like a garbage can, Trump said. You know, it's the first time I've ever said that, he continued. Every time I come up and talk about what they've done to our country, I get angrier and angrier. First time I've ever said garbage can, but you know what? It's an accurate description. Trump also said he would make the death sentence a mandatory requirement for any migrant who kills an American citizen, to which the crowd erupted in bloodthirsty cheers. The only other things that garnered such raucous applause were Trump's proposal to end taxes on tips and to stop men from playing in women's sports. The press as the enemy of the people. It wouldn't be a Trump rally if he didn't demonize the Fourth Estate. The crowds love booing during this part. They're just bad people. And until we get a free and fair press, they're just bad people, Trump said. Then Trump steered further into autocratic rhetoric. They're the enemy of the people. They are. They're the enemy of, I've been asked not to say it, I don't want to say it. They're the enemy of the people. And someday, they're not going to be the enemy of the people, I hope, Trump rambled, a proverbial devil and angel seeming to battle for his attention on his shoulders. We're pretty sure which has the higher winning percentage. Here's a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on October 25th. Top sheriff's deputy lectures residents, storms out of tense meeting. Inside Mount of Olives Lutheran Church in Phoenix, tensions were already high. For 2 hours Thursday night, Valley residents had filled the sanctuary and given an earful to Maricopa County Sheriff Russ Skinner, blasting his agency for being slow to make court-mandated reforms and perpetuating fear in the community. Before that, they'd been outside protesting along Thomas Road, warning passerby to vote against Proposition 314, which would task local authorities with enforcing immigration law. Then, Chief Deputy Stephanie Molina stood up, walked over to a microphone, and lectured the audience. Me and my staff have worked tirelessly on reform processes and efforts within MCSO, she told them before leaving the meeting in a huff. I have sacrificed my career and have sacrificed my family for members of the Hispanic community. Molina may have had enough, but hearing the concerns of community members was the meeting's explicit purpose. Since 2014, when former Sheriff Joe Arpaio led the department, the sheriff's office has been subject to federal oversight as a result of the civil rights lawsuit Melendrez v. Arpaio. Court-appointed monitor Robert Warshaw and lawyers from the U.S. Department of Justice have met with Valley residents to give updates and listen to feedback. on Thursday, there was a lot of feedback. Resident after resident, scarred by Arpaio's rampant racial profiling, expressed their continued dissatisfaction with the sheriff's office. Some worried about unsubstantiated rumors that federal oversight of the agency would end soon, though Warshaw said no such decision had been made so far as he was aware. Other community members spoke about the distrust they still harbor for the sheriff's office. Skinner, who was appointed to the office after Arpaio's successor, Paul Penzone, resigned in January, responded to many complaints directly. Proposition 314. On the minds of many was Proposition 314, a proposed law referred to the ballot by Republican lawmakers that makes it a state crime to enter the country illegally. Under the law, dubbed the Secure the Border Act, state and local authorities would be empowered to arrest and deport undocumented immigrants. The law was modeled after a Texas law that currently is the subject of a federal lawsuit and strikes many in the Latino community as a worse version of Arizona's infamous Senate Bill 1070, which the U.S. Supreme Court partially struck down in 2012. For more than an hour before the meeting with Skinner and Warshaw, activists from Barrio Defense Committees lined the street, urging drivers to vote against Proposition 314. Proposition 314 is one of the biggest threats to our community in the history of Arizona. It's the most racist bill, the most racist proposition to have ever been drafted in the state, 28-year-old activist Joel Cornejo said. It's worse than SB 1070 by a lot. The significance of the past was clear, as protesters waved signs and chanted slogans such as 314 is racist to the core, and hey, hey, ho, ho, these racist cops have got to go. They could see Pruitt's Furniture Store across the street. Nearly two decades ago, that's where Salvador Reza and day laborers protested against Arpaio's unconstitutional policing. Several county sheriffs oppose 314, and Skinner is one of them. At the meeting, he said the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office would not enforce the new law if passed, especially since the agency remains under a federal court order to not enforce immigration law. Nor do I have the resources to enforce it even if he wanted to, he added. One estimate predicted that the proposed law, which does not include funding for increased enforcement, would cost the state $314 million a year. Skinner's audience Thursday was unconvinced. For one, the sheriff's office has struggled to enact the reforms ordered by federal judge Murray Snow. Last month, Snow ordered the sheriff's office to clear its backlog of internal investigations, which sat at 1,300 open cases in July. Though the department has instituted some reforms, last year claiming it was in 90% compliance with Snow's order, community members at the meeting weren't buying it. One mother shared a recent story about sheriff's deputies pointing guns at her family, including her son with Down syndrome, and arresting her husband, only to chalk it up to a misunderstanding. They have not changed their culture. They continue to racially profile, Cornejo said before the meeting. This is a weapon that people like Jerry Sheridan are going to use against black and brown communities. Though Skinner was the target of the residents' frustration, Sheridan scares them more. He's the Republican candidate for sheriff and is facing off against Democrat Tyler Camp. Skinner, who switched his party affiliation to Democrat so he could be appointed to fill Penzone's position, lost to Camp in the primary. Sheridan was found in contempt of court for lying to Snow during the Melendres proceedings, is on the Brady list of untrustworthy cops, and has ties to the anti-government extremist group Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officer Movement. Skinner or Camp might not enforce Proposition 314 if it passes, but Sheridan very well could. If Sheridan wins, if 314 passes, and the judge takes away that damper, it's going to get out of hand, it's going to get really crazy, said 72-year-old activist Reza. If he wins, we are in trouble. Have a good night. But Sheridan's not in charge yet, and so Thursday night, concerned citizens unloaded their frustrations on Skinner. Near the end of the meeting, after activist Percy Christian criticized Skinner and his office for perpetuating harm over and over systematically, Skinner once again stood up to respond, asking, "What's your solution?" This time, though, Molina stood with him, immediately raising the temperature of the room. The tension was cut briefly when an interpreter interrupted to relay Christian's words in Spanish, but it soon returned after another speaker questioned Skinner, prompting Molina to launch into a 5-minute-long speech about the sheriff's office. "Since 2014, she began, "I've been a part of the compliance efforts in various capacities." She and her staff, quote, "have worked tirelessly on reform processes." Complaints from the Hispanic community about the sheriff's office are investigated first, she said. She then offered some statistics. Since 2016, there have been 591 complaints from the community about the agency. Of those complaints, 112 involved allegations of bias, 10 of which were sustained upon investigation. As a result, 2 deputies were fired, and 5 others were suspended following discriminatory remarks. "I would not be part of this process after Pinzone left, working for Skinner, if I didn't believe that what he was doing was honest and fair and working for the best efforts of this community," Molina continued. "I have to sacrifice a lot, and I know that doesn't mean anything to the people that have had to endure what we endured under prior sheriffs. But what I can say about Sheriff Skinner is that he's had everybody's interest in mind as we move forward over these last 10 months. And I cannot stand here and allow you to berate him like you did," she concluded. "That's all I have to say. You guys have a good night." Molina then left, saluting and high-fiving another law enforcement officer on the way out. Her exit was met with jeers from some in attendance. "You have zero dignity," Christian called out, suggesting her speech did little to assuage any community concerns. What's clear is that as Arizona voters weigh another possibly unconstitutional law that could target the Latino community, activists and organizers worry not much has changed from the days of Arpaio and SB 1070. "We know what to expect every time we come, but it's ridiculous how many lies they say," Cornejo said just after the meeting. "They just pat each other on the back." T.J. LeHoux wrote this next story, posted on October 24th. Carrie Lake is the GOP queen of election conspiracy theories, according to a report. If bullshit election claims were votes, Carrie Lake would be assured a seat in the Senate already. Ever since Joe Biden won the 2020 election over Donald Trump, election conspiracy theories have spread like wildfire. They've caused rifts within the Republican Party, putting Trump's MAGA faithful against establishment GOP figures across the country. That's been especially true in Maricopa County, where the Board of Supervisors and County Recorder have been the subject of violent threats over their roles in administering the 2020 and 2022 elections. As recently as Tuesday, someone was sent to prison for making threats against the Maricopa County Elections Department. On Wednesday, the Washington Post released an analysis tracing the origin of that election interference rancor. The newspaper tracked the social media posts of current candidates for elected office across the country, with Trump himself excepted, to see who posted or amplified a range of falsehoods or misinformation about election malfeasance. Who's the queen of election interference claims? Why, it's none other than Arizona's own Carrie Lake. And it's not even close. The Republican Senate candidate and failed 2022 candidate for governor, has posted more than 250 times about election interference in the 2024 election. In second place, with roughly 150 posts each, were Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Elise Stefanik of New York, two notable extreme right-wing members of Congress. The only other Senate candidate in the post's top 10 is Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who posted more than 100 times about election interference conspiracies. The Lake campaign did not respond to Phoenix New Times' request for comment on the analysis. The post analysis covers the period from November 9, 2022 to October 11th of this year. It categorized posts by various topics, including non-citizen voting, Trump's court cases, and falsely calling Kamala Harris's elevation to the top of the Democratic ticket a coup to oust Biden. One of Lake's tweets, an August missive about Harris's stolen nomination, was included as an example of the latter. Given Lake's dismal poll numbers, and especially given her terrible record trying election cases in court, including losing a defamation case brought by Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Ricker, she might want to start singing a different tune. Here's a related story written by T.J. LeHeroux and posted on October 22nd. Does Carrie Lake really hunt, or is she just hunting for votes? It's almost always the same photo. In it, Carrie Lake is kneeling against a wooded backdrop wearing khaki pants, a camouflage shirt, and a brown and tan Carrie Lake hat. Through sunglasses, she looks off to the side, a big grin on her face. One hand holds a pump-action shotgun, barrel pointed to the sky. It's a good picture, which is perhaps why the Republican candidate for Senate has used it so often. She posted it to social media on September 23, 2023, to celebrate National Hunting and Fishing Day. This year, the former newscaster has reposted it twice, on September 1st, for the opening day of hunting season, and on October 12th, in an apparent taunt of Kamala Harris's running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. The posts, particularly the dig at Walz, are designed to give the impression that Lake is a seasoned hunter. But is that impression accurate? Phoenix New Times attempted to find out. Records from the Arizona Game and Fish Department show that between 1999 and June 2024, the years Lake has lived in Arizona, she and her husband, Jeff Halperin, held hunting licenses for only 1 year. They purchased them on August 30th, 2021, while Lake was running for governor. They expired a year later, months before she lost the 2022 election to Katie Hobbs. Lake and Halperin also each purchased a stamp to hunt migratory birds on the same day they purchased their licenses, just 2 days before dove season opened. It's unclear whether Lake purchased a license this year. When asked if Lake currently has a hunting license, campaign spokesperson Alex Nicole responded, "Carrie Lake follows the law, so of course she's had a hunting license every time she's gone hunting, a fishing license every time she's gone fishing, and a driving license every time she's driven. Oh, and an ID every time she's voted." If Lake actually has hunted, her social media posts are light on details. The one time Lake shared a different hunting photo, on September 1st, 2023, the first day of hunting season that year, she's captured from a different angle, but wearing a nearly identical outfit and sitting in a nearly identical stance. Seeking an expert opinion about whether Lake's hunting posts pass the smell test, New Times showed Lake's photos to Chandler resident Frank Cota, a 64-year-old U.S. Marine Corps veteran and lifelong hunter. He immediately noticed a safety concern. "If she had any safety in her brain right there," Cota said, "she would be holding that weapon with two hands." The nonchalance also bothered him. Lake's photos do not include any kills, a staple of a successful hunting trip. Instead, Lake comes across as a literal poser. That is just like a pose right there, Coda said. I mean, she looks too happy. To me, that's what the giveaway is. If Lake is hunting for anything, Coda said, she's using photos to hunt for votes. If the polls are any indication, she needs them. And if a recent event appearance is any indication, Lake's aim could use some work. I love the Second Amendment. On October 15th, the hunter advocacy group Hunter Nation held a virtual campfire talk show. The event was hosted by music legend Ted Nugent and Keith Mark, a workers' compensation lawyer and the organization's president. Their special guest, Carrie Lake. From the beginning, the subject of politicians posing as hunters was top of mind. Isn't it offensive, Mark asked rhetorically, when politicians pander for hunter votes in just a few weeks? Mark then turned his attention to Lake. I love your posts about deer hunting, Mark gushed. You come across as a legitimate, real hunter because you post about hunting, not just every now and again. He then made a request. Tell us a Carrie Lake hunting story. Immediately, Lake seemed thrown off. She offered a quick correction. She is not a deer hunter. As for a story, the best she could manage was a tale about giving her staff the day off to dove hunt on the first day of the season. They were all asking to have the first day of dove season off, and I finally just had to say okay. Okay, literally, everyone can have September 1 off, because I knew that they were going to come up with mystery ailments if I didn't do it, Lake told the group. She and her family ended up joining the group, she said, adding that her daughter was the most successful hunter of the day. That was just beginner's luck, Lake noted, a comment that suggested family hunting trips are hardly a frequent occurrence. Seemingly aware that she bricked a layup, Lake sped off on a tangent about her love of guns. I'm more of a Second Amendment. I love the Second Amendment, Lake said. I love target shooting, and I like to practice so that if I ever, God forbid, have to use my weapon, I pity the fool that I have to use it against, because my husband and I go target practicing all the time. Reached by phone, Mark said he wasn't bothered that Lake's social posts led him to think that she was a legitimate real hunter, as he said during his talk show. He noted that Lake didn't try to bullshit on air about her lack of hunting experience. She didn't try to mislead Ted and I, Mark said. She made it very clear that it wasn't really her thing. Mark is a self-described lifelong Democrat and labor union attorney, although he donated heavily to the failed Kansas gubernatorial bid of Republican Kris Kobach and, as the Kansas City Star reported in 2018, landed a small role in the Trump administration, serving on an advisory board that is helping the U.S. Department of the Interior rewrite federal rules for importing the heads and hides of African elephants and other animals. That same year, he and Kobach formed Hunter Nation. Speaking to New Times, Mark expressed disappointment that Lake's opponent, Democratic Representative Ruben Gallego, did not join Nugent and him on the program. Whatever Lake's hunting background, he said, she'd showed up. If she is a limited hunter, but was willing to take the time and come on our podcast and listen to Hunting Issues and say she supports what our organization stands for, that's impressive to me, Mark said. It's even more impressive to me that she's not a diehard hunter because she cared enough to listen to us. But at least one veteran hunter isn't buying her social media act. I've lived here forever and seen her on the news forever, but I've never, ever heard her talk about hunting, Coda said. Most of her political story is just making stuff up as she goes. Can Anna Hernandez bring progressive reform to Phoenix? This next piece, the cover story of this week's print edition of the New Times, was written by T.J. LaHarue and was posted on the New Times website on October 21st. State Senator Anna Hernandez didn't expect to become an elected official. Well into a career selling mortgages in corporate America, the Phoenix native was doing well for herself. Then, in 2019, Phoenix police shot and killed her brother, Alejandro, while he was experiencing a mental health crisis. She started asking questions about Alejandro's killing. The death certificate from a funeral home showed Alejandro had multiple gunshot wounds, contradicting the police narrative. When we talked to the detective the day that they killed him, Hernandez said, they had said my brother was only shot one time. That was the moment I really started getting involved, Hernandez said of Alejandro's death. A tattoo of her brother adorns her forearm. It's an ever-present reminder of the profound pain that's fueled a fiery mission to bring change and justice to the valley. In 2022, Hernandez ran for state legislature, upsetting incumbent State Senator Cesar Chavez in the primary before running unopposed in the general election. For the past 2 years, the 42-year-old has been a passionate and outspoken advocate of progressive causes, loudly arguing in favor of police and housing reform. Now, after one term, Hernandez has set her sights on different, more local territory. Instead of running for re-election in the legislature, the progressive firebrand is attempting to hop down to Phoenix City Council, where she can exert influence on the fifth largest city in the United States. It's far from a sure bet. Hernandez is one of four candidates vying for a spot representing District 7, which encompasses much of Central and West Phoenix. The others are Martin Bridgman, a realtor whose campaign priorities are largely progressive, Michael Nowakowski, a controversial former council member with a history of anti-LGBTQ sentiments and corruption allegations, and former State Representative Marcelino Quiñones, who resigned to jump into the race after Hernandez announced her candidacy. Hernandez's main competition is Quiñones, who dons dapper suits and sports slicked-back hair. Almost all major figures of Phoenix's political class have endorsed him, including Mayor Kate Gallego and U.S. Representative Ruben Gallego. Quiñones also has the backing of former Vice Mayor Yasemin Ansari, who vacated the District 7 seat to run for Congress, and interim council member Carlos Galindo Elvira, who was appointed to the body when Ansari left. Hernandez, who has never cared much about the establishment's approval, boasts support from the grassroots. Her campaign website touts endorsements from 18 political organizations and labor unions, including Planned Parenthood Advocates of Arizona, Worker Power, the AFL-CIO, Unite Here, Local 11, Young Democrats of Arizona, and the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. 10 organizations and unions have endorsed Quiñones. If Hernandez is more of an outsider, that's good, she says. With so many establishment centrists at the helm, Phoenix City Council needs one. I'm still part of this community. I try my best to be out there talking to different folks that are affected by those decisions that happen. I think that is missing in a big way on the council, Hernandez said. The majority of the council function within the status quo and aren't shaking things up, not looking outside the box, not out there talking to the constituency that needs to be talked to, the ones that are struggling to make ends meet. Police reform. Earlier this month, Hernandez trekked through the Roosevelt neighborhood on the edge of District 7. As she knocked on door after door, more and more residents told her that only she and Bridgman had come by to hear their concerns. Their concerns are also hers, Hernandez says. She's focused her campaign on a few core topics, including housing and homelessness. Another is at the heart of her own life story, public safety, a term Hernandez says often is misconstrued as more policing and more funding for cops. Public safety is so much more than that. It's safe housing, it's healthy neighborhoods. It's can people go to use their parks and be safe in their parks, Hernandez said. It's do I have safe child care where my kids can go? Are there after-school programs that are going to keep our kids off the street? It is also policing, of course. If elected, Hernandez would immediately become the city council's most outspoken critic of Phoenix's notoriously violent police force. Since 2014, Phoenix police have killed hundreds of people, including Hernandez's brother, with countless stories of loss that could have been avoided. In June, the U.S. Department of Justice reported that Phoenix police have a pattern of discriminating by race, using excessive force, and trampling the rights of homeless people. While establishment figures such as Representative Gallego and Mayor Gallego have been wary of publicly critiquing police, Hernandez has not been shy about doing so. When video surfaced earlier this month of Phoenix cops beating and tasing a deaf black man in August, Democrats on the council put out mealy-mouthed, "We're very concerned" statements. In contrast, Hernandez and State Representative Annalise Ortiz released a statement calling the incident indicative of the larger systemic problems within the Phoenix Police Department. In January, Ortiz and Hernandez also teamed up in the legislature to introduce a Family Bill of Rights, which aimed to bring transparency and support to people injured by police and relatives of those killed by law enforcement officers. The bill, which was never heard by the legislature, was informed by Hernandez's personal experience. As we navigated the system in looking for answers and accountability on police violence, we faced endless roadblocks in obtaining police reports, investigative reports, personal belongings of our loved ones, and access to resources, Hernandez said at a press conference introducing the bill. In a statement provided to New Times, Ortiz called Hernandez the only candidate who can be trusted to advocate for meaningful transparency, accountability, and reform for the Phoenix Police Department. While Hernandez is more than willing to call out bad policing, she refutes the notion that she hates cops, with whom she'll need to have a productive relationship if elected. She said that she has engaged with law enforcement for years and doesn't shy away from those relationships. Her main issue is the fundamental role of the cop in Phoenix and more broadly. Though, like many already on the council, she's not sure if a consent decree with the DOJ is the answer to Phoenix's issues. We've become this society that wants to use police to address every single social issue we have. It's not good for anybody, Hernandez said. We have to look at public safety through a different lens, and that's part of the work, right? Housing and homelessness. Policing may be the buzziest issue Phoenix faces, but it's hardly the only one. While Hernandez knocked doors in downtown Phoenix, the first concern many residents raised was about Phoenix's twin crises. Housing and homelessness come up every day on the doors, she said. On the issue of housing, Hernandez has shown the ability to work across the aisle. She was a leader in the Senate on bipartisan solutions for housing problems, sponsoring a bill to legalize the construction of accessory dwelling units, commonly called casitas, to help alleviate the state's housing shortage. The bill passed both the House and Senate with bipartisan support before being signed into law by Governor Katie Hobbs. It was a rare win for those trying to address the housing crisis. People don't want to change the status quo to actually bring solutions, Hernandez said. So, what I was able to lead on these two past years has been huge and unheard of, because nobody can ever get that done. The bill was opposed by the League of Cities and Towns, including Phoenix, which objected to the fact that the bill allowed casitas to be used as short-term rentals. That clash played out in public earlier this year. At an October 8th council meeting, Mayor Gallego engaged in a rare, seemingly forced moment of name-dropping. usually averse to saying anything all that confrontational, Gallego called out Hernandez for her role in passing the bill over the city's opposition. We got some pushback even from Phoenix's own legislators. For example, State Senator Ana Hernandez, Gallego said, going on to read a Hernandez quote about how exclusionary zoning was a bigger issue than allowing casitas to be used as Airbnbs. It's just very disappointing. In a statement to New Times, Gallego noted that she often comments on the work of the Arizona legislature and how it continuously preempts cities from making common sense decisions. While she noted she usually directs such comments at Republicans, in this case it was Senator Hernandez, who worked with big developer lobbyists to pass some pretty bad policies. Gallego added that the city attempted to work with Hernandez on the bill, but found little traction. To Hernandez, the episode was a sign that the city's priorities are out of whack. She feels Phoenix needs immediate fixes to housing and homelessness, not long-delayed perfect ones. We're never going to find one solution to the housing problem or the homelessness problem, she said. But we have to have the political courage to say, hey, we need to address this, and these are the different steps we can take. One step would address the Valley's eviction crisis, which was on pace to break records earlier this year. Hernandez wants to create a right-to-counsel program for people who are evicted, something she and her campaign manager, Luke Black, say would cost between $500,000 and $1 million in city funds, and would prevent homelessness ahead of time. That should be a pittance for a city the size of Phoenix, Black said. But he noted that the city can't find that money in a budget where they're already giving close to $1 billion to the police. There's a wild disconnect. Passing meaningful house reform rather than more camping bans that target the city's sizable unhoused population would make for an uphill battle. Phoenix's centrist council members are cozy with landlords, Black claims. Campaign finance records show that in 2023, Phoenix Association of Realtors donated more than $100,000 to the Political Action Committee Invest in Phoenix, which is run by associates of Mayor Gallego Ansari and council member Keisha Hodge Washington. The Realtors Association also has endorsed Quiñones. One of the ways folks end up homeless is through the rental market. It's through evictions and predatory landlords, Black said. We have to remember that the political establishment is not interested in changing this, which is why we see the landlords endorsing Marcelino. We know that they benefit from the status quo, and they made a move to support the person that would keep the status quo in place. Gallego campaign spokesperson Kevin Kirchmeier noted that the Realtors Association contributed to the Phoenix Bond campaign, which will invest more than $55 million in affordable housing, including in the district Hernandez is running to represent. Kirchmeier also criticized Hernandez's support from the Home Builders Association of Central Arizona, which he claimed prompted her to change her position on Senate Bill 1172. Which affected groundwater pumping rights. Hernandez was the lone Democrat to support it, and afterward, Kirchmeier said, the Home Builders Association repaid the favor and donated $1,000 to Hernandez's city council campaign. Governor Katie Hobbs ultimately vetoed the bill. The Home Builders Association also gave the same amount to council members Ann O'Brien, Jim Waring, and J.J. Martinez, who is challenging Councilmember Betty Guardado in District 5. Last election cycle, the association donated $1,000 each to Waring and Washington. When asked about the opposition to her housing plans, Hernandez can only laugh. It's funny, because my work on housing has become so much more controversial than my work on policing, she said. I guess I wasn't prepared for that. Challenges ahead. If Hernandez wins, though, she better prepare for a fight. She'll be walking into a lion's den of pre-existing opposition at City Hall. The first step is coming out on top November 5th, or at least finishing high enough to advance to the runoff election in March. In a crowded field, most of the support seems to be coalescing around Hernandez and Quiñones. Both Hernandez and Black suspect Gallego recruited Quiñones to run because he is unlikely to challenge the status quo. Kirchmeier said Gallego encouraged Quiñones to run, though Quiñones could not be reached for comment. That echoes a race in 2023, when outspoken progressive council member Carlos Garcia was unseated by Washington, whom Mayor Gallego endorsed. New Times was unable to reach Garcia to speak about his experience as one of the council's progressive voices. Black said Mayor Gallego's firm opposition and attack on Hernandez show how determined the mayor is to preserve the status quo. This is the mayor's council. She has built this council over time by strategically recruiting candidates to run in races. The result of that has been, at this point, the mayor controls at least 5 votes, Black said. What that has meant for this city is we're in a housing crisis with no solutions. We're in an eviction and rent crisis with no solutions. We have a police budget that's totally out of control, with no guardrails. Kirchmeier countered that Phoenix has a very strong council of independent leaders, all of whom have voted differently than the mayor. He said Gallego led the effort to recruit current council member Kevin Robinson, but that she did not recruit any other members of the city council. In a much smaller legislative body, it's true that Hernandez could encounter colder treatment from Gallego and her allies. The shot Gallego took at her over the housing bill was hardly the only time the conflict has spilled into the open. In May 2023, the council voted 5-4, with Gallego joining its conservative wing in support, to ban public comment, a move that prevented mobile home residents facing imminent eviction from speaking. Hernandez, who was in attendance, rose up in a fury and lambasted the council. "If you shut them down, I will make it my goal to shut the city down," Hernandez boomed, pointing her finger at the council. Perhaps that's why some who have endorsed Quiñones have tacitly suggested Hernandez doesn't play well enough with others to serve on the council. Ansari tended to side with the progressive wing of the council and voted against silencing the mobile home residents. Still, she told the Arizona Republic that she endorsed Quiñones partly due to his interpersonal skills. "I think that I trust more in Marcelino's temperament to deal with some of these challenging issues, without alienating too many other members of the council," Ansari said. Ansari declined to comment when reached by New Times. In her statement, Gallego downplayed the effect any discord between her and Hernandez would have on how the council functions. "I have a long record of working with people of all political walks of life," the statement said, "and I'll always put aside differences to move Phoenix forward." While Galindo Elvira has also endorsed Quiñones, he stressed to New Times that he by no means is rebuking Hernandez. "I have nothing against Ana Hernandez," he said. "When I endorsed Marcelino, I let her know that I would not be campaigning against her or attack her in any way, shape, or form." Galindo Elvira is also on the ballot for District 7, but only to fill Ansari's seat for the final 4 months of her term. If Mayor Gallego is marshaling her resources to defeat Hernandez, that wouldn't surprise the state lawmaker. She knows she gets under the mayor's skin because she doesn't play by the same rules. In politics, we gain political capital that we can use at different times. "I've saved my political capital to make sure it's actual things that benefit the community. Not everyone works that way," Hernandez said. Sometimes, the higher elected officials, when they gain more power, become much more disconnected from the community they serve. That's the message Hernandez is taking to voters, with voting already underway. She'll need to win a seat, and then she'll need to show that she can get things done. Plenty of progressive goals have been stymied by the city council, which has undercut its own police oversight agency and further criminalized homelessness. Accomplishing meaningful change will require fighting, but also give and take with council members, who aren't perfectly aligned with Hernandez. She is undaunted by that challenge. Hernandez worked across the aisle in the Arizona legislature with lawmakers much more hostile to progressive ideas than those on the city council. And she feels ready to help steer her city in the same way. "I know how to work," Hernandez said, her dark eyes as determined and intense as ever. Phoenix highway construction sign hacked to say, "Fuck Israel, save Gaza." This next story was written by Zach Buchanan and was posted on October 23rd. We're all used to flashing signs on the highway. "Road work ahead," some blare, while others offer pithy reasons to buckle your seatbelt. But on one stretch of Phoenix Road early Wednesday morning, drivers got a much different message. Around 2 a.m., near the southbound Camelback Road entrance to Interstate 17, a portable road sign was hacked to read, "Fuck Israel, save Gaza." In a video shared online, an Arizona Department of Public Safety vehicle can be seen parked nearby, its lights blurring. Footage of the sign was shared by the Instagram account PHX_news_photog and later reposted to X. Israel's ongoing war against Hamas in Gaza has resulted in more than 40,000 people dead, including many women and children. Israel launched the war in response to a surprise attack by Hamas on October 7, 2023, that killed more than 1,200 Israelis and took more than 250 people hostage. Protests over the war roiled Arizona State University's campus in April and also have erupted at Kamala Harris events across Arizona. Eric Andrews, a spokesperson for DPS, said a state trooper reported the sign to the Arizona Department of Transportation, which oversees highway signs. ADOT spokesperson Steve Elliott said the sign, which has been corrected, belongs to an ADOT contractor and is in place for a fog seal project on I-17. "We have counseled the contractor on the need to be vigilant about securing portable message boards, and the contractor is upgrading passwords and locks," Elliott said in an email. He also added, "We want to emphasize that this did not involve ADOT system of freeway digital message signs." It's not clear how the sign was hacked. However, according to State Scoop, highway signs can be surprisingly easy to reprogram, often by someone exploiting the device through a factory default password that's been widely distributed around the internet. Here's a story by TJ LeHeru and posted on October 23rd. "What's this slice of Phoenix called? Online debate divides Valley." We all know how to define Central City: Maryvale, Deer Valley, Ahwatukee. These are clearly understood parts of Phoenix. But one area evades a simple definition. That area is, well, it has no clear name. Its boundaries are Interstate 17 to the west and State Route 51 to the east. It runs from Bethany Home Road north to Dunlap Avenue. That area is noticeably different from its surrounding area, as one Phoenix Redditor recently noted, how it's much more affluent and wealthy. But what's it called? "Old money," wrote one user. "Greenville," said another, "for its greenery and how rich people are." But the most common answers included the words North Central. "North Central Phoenix is what I've always called it," said one Redditor. "It exists north of Uptown and south of Sunnyslope." "North Central Corridor," someone else suggested. Another said it was North Central into Sunnyslope. Then, discussion turned to another burning question. What does one call the area between 7th Street and 7th Avenue? You normally hear this area referred to as North Central Phoenix or between the 7s, wrote one person. Another called it the Central Corridor because that's what my mother-in-law, who was born here and is a real estate agent, has always called it. One other user posted a map of Phoenix's official villages, which divides the area into two zones. There's a southern expanse called Alhambra and a northern region called North Mountain, with Northern Avenue serving as the border between them. Those names may be official, but they weren't satisfying. One user insisted that the Alhambra area is really Uptown. Another concurred, defining Uptown as Camelback to Northern, generally. The post, which went up last week, now has more than 300 comments, so don't expect consensus anytime soon. Anyway, as one person pointed out, what you call a place is less important than what it means to you. I call it, one user wrote, where I used to get high. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for more interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrock. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then click on Demand Broadcasts, scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen.